Ladies and gentlemen, please take your seats.
You know, now more than ever, it's so bloody important to remember the classics. And guess what? If you're within the sound of my voice, that must mean you're in the seats with once more. As always, my name is Dave Voigt, and I'm the host of this podcast, where we sit down with a wide-ranging variety of entertainment industry professionals, and we pick their brain about current projects, state of the industry, how they got started, and so very much more, enlightened in a conversational fashion. And you know, if you like how we do things around here, I am going to go out on a limb and assume that you do, because let's face it, you're listening right now. And if you are listening, then subscribe. Hit subscribe, give us that 5-star rating on your podcast provider of choice. Hit the like button, do all that fun stuff. We're available pretty much everywhere. Places like Apple, Amazon, Spotify, Google, and plus we archive every single one of our episodes over at our In the Seats YouTube channel. We'd really appreciate it. Give us a like and subscribe there too. It means a lot. Also, check us out on the social media. We're on the Facebook, the Twitter, or as I call it, Twix, the Instagram, the Letterboxd, the TikTok, the Threads, the Tumblr. Well, we're in a lot of places, at In the Seats, for all sorts of fun updates. And finally, and I do dare say most importantly, please pay us a visit over at In the Seats, intheseats.ca, for all the latest and greatest from the world of film, television, basically the moving image at large. Because guess what? If we love to watch it and write about it and talk about it, we love it even more when you come by and read about it and listen about it. So please do us that kindness and pay us a visit. On this very special episode, we are reminiscing about, well, one of the best that ever did it. The man, the myth, the legend, the one and only Gene Wilder, who has a documentary about his life. Excuse me for that. Coming out today. Playing here in Toronto the Hot Docs Ted Rogers Theater. How could I forget? But it's called Remembering Gene Wilder. It is a fantastic documentary and tribute honoring the life and career of the man himself. And we had the unique pleasure of not only watching the film, which is great, don't miss it. Try to go see it over at the Ted Rogers Hot Dog Cinema or catch it on Blu-ray in about 6 weeks, I think, when it's coming out. But first, we had a conversation with the one and only director of the film, Mr. Ron Frank, and we really got in-depth on just sort of the legacy of Gene and making the movie and sort of the joy therein, because Gene Wilder was one of those performers that just brought this sort of unbridled joy to everything that he did. He bucked the system. He wasn't the guy you'd think would be a leading man, but he was a comedic leading man, and damn if he was a good one. He's one of my personal favorites, and he always made me laugh. I mean, there's luminaries like Mel Brooks, Alan Alda, tons of people who worked with him, tons of people who loved him, really sort of waxing philosophical on how important he was as a performer to the landscape that we're living in. But like I said, when you get a chance, go check out Remembering Gene Wilder, which here in Toronto is playing over at the Hot Docs Ted Rogers Cinema for a few days, or check it out on video on demand and Blu-ray when it hits in about a month or 6 weeks from now. We'll be talking about it more on this feed because it's a gorgeous thing. It's one that is going on our shelf for sure at some point. It's that kind of movie, especially if you're a cinephile or pop culture person. It's really a great piece. But like I said, check out Remembering Gene Wilder wherever you can. But first, enjoy our talk with Ron Frank, the director of the film, because, as always, it was a darn good one.
I had to do this on the run today, but I mean, just first off, obviously, thank you so much for the time. I really do appreciate this. And I mean, congrats on the film. I thought it was lovely. I really did.
Thank you.
I mean, I guess the first question is, like, what was sort of the impetus to kick off to be the person to tackle the life of Gene Wilder?
Well, I'll try to make it a short answer. The answer is that my executive producers are David Knight and Julie Nimoy. Julie being the daughter of Leonard Nimoy.
Right.
Julie and I and David did a film about Leonard and also what he died from, which was COPD. After he died, we made that movie. And when Gene passed, the Wilders and the Nimoys were close friends. And when Gene passed, it was David and Julie's idea to approach Karen, his widow, to do a film about Gene, particularly what he suffered through with Alzheimer's. We wanted to expand that. My writer and I, Glenn Kirschbaum and I, wanted to expand that to include Gene's broad career and celebrate it and his life. And so we did. The Alzheimer's part became a very small part of the film, but we got into it and started, you know, we just expanded. I would say that after we interviewed Mel, all the dominoes sort of fell into place. So that's how it really began.
Well, I can imagine. I mean, especially doing research on something like this. I mean, is it as simple as, you know, getting access to Mel's basement? Or, I mean, is it more sort of involved in finding all these archival stills? And I mean, even sort of his voiceover kind of semi-narrating the whole thing. Like, was that like an audiobook or something?
Yes, that Gene wrote an autobiography called Kiss Me Like a Stranger. And he did, fortunately for us, an audiobook companion to that. And we licensed it and took excerpts from that. And we knew what meant to most of him. I mean, we couldn't do it all, 300 some odd pages, but we knew what meant most to him was most important to him, because he repeated certain stories in other interviews. And we also, I didn't want to do it, you know, I couldn't do a Gene interview, it's gone, but we could have licensed one, but we just wanted him to tell the story in first person. So that's what we did. We had him tell it in first person. And I think the technique, which is not completely unique, but it really brings the audience to his storytelling, right up to his storytelling. He's telling us his story, which he did in the book. So that proved to be, I think, a lot more effective than were he alive today and we did the typical interview. This is a much more closer narrative to tell the story this way.
How did you manage to boil it all down? Because, I mean, honestly, you could have done a film about him on The Producers or him on Saddles or just his relationship with Richard. There was so much material to choose from. How did you manage to sort of pare it down to the 90-odd minutes that you got it to?
You are so right. I mean, we had a one time where I had about almost 120-minute version of this, too long. It's too long to make, not that the material wasn't good, but I think it's just too long to make audiences sit through necessarily sometimes a documentary of that length.
Right.
And so we had to pick and choose, and the choices were not easy, but what we did is we went through his movies and where Gene had something to say about them, and particularly, you know, his classics, how could we not include them?
Yeah.
The more famous ones, but there were a lot of duds too, and we didn't go there. He did some. I think my regret is we didn't go into a lot of his. You know, he after he did The Producers, Mel wanted to bring him closer, and Gene wanted to do his own thing. So he ended up doing Little Prince and Rhinoceros and Quackster Fortune and these little films that a lot of people haven't heard of. That weren't box office hits, but were cute films in and of their own, just not extremely popular like the others that he had done during that time. So we figured that we're not going to concentrate on those and concentrate on his big ones. And really, each film that we focused on was really what it meant to Gene. What everything around the film was mostly how it affected Gene, how it propelled his life forward in terms of his career. That was starting with The Producers. When we interviewed Mel, and Mel said that Joe Levine wanted to fire him, get him and replace him with somebody else. And Mel said, yeah, you're right, you got it. And he would never talk to the guy. He was smart because we wouldn't probably be talking today had Mel not, you know, been kept Gene in the Producers. And he proved Joe Levine wrong because he got an Oscar nomination, Gene did, for Best Supporting Actor for The Producers. So things that affected the trajectory of Gene's life is where we were most focused on.
Was everyone more or less on board to talk on camera about Gene? Or was it, like you said, was Mel kind of the domino to get everyone else to fall in line?
Mel was kind of the domino. The only one we did not get that I wish we had gotten was Harrison Ford to talk about Crisco Kid. Harrison turned us down. And then there were others who unfortunately passed away. We wanted to get Sidney Poitier. He had just died while we were in production. Charles Grodin, same thing. He passed away. Gene was very close friends with him. So there were those folks we were not able to get. But we got everybody else, Carol Kane and Alan Alda, Michael Gruskoff, producer of the Young Frankenstein. So we were able to get a lot of folks that we were hoping to.
How important was it for you to make this not so much a retrospective, but just more to get us insight on the tender moments of his career? Because I mean, I love the fact that, you know, you spent a good chunk of Young Frankenstein just talking about how Marty Feldman kept breaking them on set. You know, that those are the sweeter moments that, at least as a fan, I think I feel appreciated way more than just sort of a historical sort of look back at the production thereof, you know?
Well, you'll notice that we really didn't get into detail about any of the movies and the plot.
Yeah.
We would summarize it maybe in a line like Blazing Saddles. You know, Mel needed to say, for those people who, maybe the minority who hasn't really known or seen the movie, Mel needed to say this was a film, you know, primarily about racism and making fun of it. But largely we stayed away from the plot. I mean, I could have, like you said originally, I could have made a whole movie about the producers. Mel talked about it in detail. I mean, there's so much more I know, and we couldn't put it in. It really didn't affect Gene necessarily. So we kind of shied away from that. But I think for the most part, we, like I said, concentrated on films and how it affected, came across to Gene. Even in the Blazing Saddles, we got Burton Gilliam, who has the distinct honor of being the first one to pass wind on a motion picture screen, you know, because he started the chorus of that famous scene. So, but he talked to us even about what it was like to work with Gene. So did Bert, so did Peter Ostrom from Willy Wonka. You know, all these individuals, we wanted to know, okay, tell us about Gene, your relationship with Gene. Nancy Neufeld, when she was 12 years old in The Frisco Kid, got a little bit part in that. And she told us what it was like to work with Gene. So that, Carol Kane, same thing. So that was really the reason why we brought all these people in, and to get an understanding of what Gene was like off screen personally. So, and Karen filled that in for us very well.
It really felt like the film was giving us a sense of the legacy of not only what kind of a performer he was, but just also that era of comedy as well. Because I mean, so many of his classic performances in films are films that, I mean, you couldn't make these today if you had free license to you know, had all the money in the world to do whatever you want. There's no way in hell you could get them made. But I mean, these were classic bits. I mean, just to, you know, to have like Gene Sell being in love with a sheep, you know, it's not something you could pull off today. Was there a sense of sort of appreciation of the legacy, especially as you were talking to everyone and really kind of reminiscing and putting all this together?
Well, I mean, you're right about that. The sensibility of the late 60s and throughout the 70s, it's completely different now. I was lucky enough to see these movies in the movie theater, the earlier ones, which I think is the best place to see them. I mean, of course, Netflix, but seeing with an audience was, you know, remarkable. But I think as a whole, the experience of looking at the sheep, for instance, so our executive producer, Julie, she didn't want that in. She just at first felt that it was like, no, it's, you know, and we also had it, we showed a cut to public television here in the US, and they said, no bestiality, we cut that out. You know, if you want to sell it to us, you got to cut that out. And we said, well, it's great. But with Julie, Glenn and I, my writer and I, we did what Mel said, you know, don't say, you're right, you got it, it's out. And we just left.
I love it.
Audiences appreciate it, you know, to this day. So, I mean, that was about that. You're right. I mean, those kind of things could not be done today. And I don't think it's because they are shocking. I think the audience has changed. Not the filmmaking, not the comedy. or anything else. It's the audience. Their sensibilities have changed. If I saw it, and maybe it's an age thing, if I saw it, I would laugh my head off. But I guess people are more sensitive now and more critical. That's for sure. So maybe that has something to do with it.
Was there anything in this entire process that maybe surprised you about Gene? Because in watching it, I was struck by just of how giving a performer he was. And really in many ways, it kind of reminded me almost of someone like Robin's legacy and just sort of the stories that people would tell about him. Like, was there anything about Gene sort of as you were going along this process that maybe caught you off guard?
I did not know about Gene's personality off screen, but it was very similar to what you saw on screen. Gene was a comedic actor, not a comedian. And I think I don't think he had necessarily, he wasn't as witty off screen, but there was a likableness about his personality and affection that came across. Everybody has told me, I never met him, unfortunately, but everybody has told me he was kind, soft-spoken. He looked at you in the eye when he talked to you. You were the only one in the room. Didn't matter who you were. He treated everybody the same. There was just a very calm demeanor about him. I think that even expanded as he got older. But that's the sense that I got. Particularly, I got it when he was dating Karen. Karen said, he really listened, which most men, ask my wife, they don't do. I could see that about him. And he took care of treating fans because, particularly kids, he was Willy Wonka. And when he got bumped into a street or something, he accepted that. A lot of actors, they don't always want to do that, but he accepted that. A mother came up to me after a screening in Stamford when she went trick-or-treating with her 9-year-old son. Gene was ill then in Stamford and came to the door. Invited them in. I wanted to see Willy Wonka, the boy said. So he invited them in and spent some time talking, no ego, no nothing. And the kid never forgot it. So that was Gene.
Was there any hesitancy to remind the audiences that Willy Wonka did kind of tank sort of on its initial run?
It wasn't for me. When I was a kid growing up, I never heard of the movie. The only reason I know it is because of DVD and VHS.
Yeah.
And my kid saw it. But I never gravitated to it. I missed it back in whenever it was, 71, I believe it got released. And to talk about it, Gene talks about it rather starkly in his autobiography. He had a few bombs. And he even said, I don't know if Little Prince did that well. I can't remember. It was during that era. So I don't know if it was before or after Willy Wonka, but he did those little Quacks to Fortune, those little oddball, little real art house indies. And they all didn't do well. And he was very afraid that this would be the end of his career. He was just getting one Start the Revolution Without Me, I believe. He was just worried about his career going south and then Willy Wonka. So when he said, he says in his book, he did everything you want to know about sex, really to resurrect his career. But also he thought he was right for the part. He understood where Woody Allen was coming from.
No, I love the line that, he said just without being wilder and wanting to be wilder. And that really does feel like such a great way to sum up him as a performer. But I'm kind of curious, having done this deep dive, how would you now sort of, an expert on Gene Wilder, sum up Gene Wilder the man?
Well, I think the first thing, if I wrote a book or did another movie, I'd call it Wilder. I like that as a title. He was a good-hearted person who really enjoyed making people laugh like he did with his mother. And in terms of making his mother laugh, which he needed to do because she had a heart attack and it almost killed her. Did I tell you the story already? Because I've been many times. I've been doing a series of you know, back to back. So I don't know who I told this story to.
It's okay.
So, you know, Gene tells us, and we have it in the movie, that his mother suffered a heart attack when he was young. And the doctor said, told him, don't ever argue with her. Try to make her laugh. Quite a burden to put on a little kid. And he did make her laugh by watching routines, Jerry Lewis and Sid Caesar, Danny Kaye. And he did make her laugh. So I think for him, and he's not a New York Jew, there's a difference. He's a Midwestern Jew.
Yeah. And
so he didn't have the same, I don't know. He had, you know, Jewish jokes in the genes, as you would say, but I don't think it was the same as Mel Brooks, for example. You know, Mel Brooks, born and bred Brooklyn guy from, you know, and a Brooklyn Jew. And that makes a difference in terms of humor. But Gene had a great sense of timing. And he also, he made things real by being natural. He didn't force humor. He didn't force his antics or anything else like that. He was, like Ben Mankiewicz says in our movie, he was like, I believe him. I could see him, right? He could be me, you know, in an absurd situation. But he just executed it with a certain amount of brilliance. I would have liked to have met him because I like the demeanor that he held. He was also not a Hollywood guy. He settled more or less in Stamford, Connecticut, was an East Coast guy, but he was not enamored with Hollywood. He doesn't have a star in the Hollywood Boulevard Walk of Fame. He just wasn't important to him. What was important to him was his creativity. And when it wasn't acting, eventually that ended, it was writing or it was painting and it was even music. So that was the most important thing. And I understand that, to have a creative outlet.
Well, no, 100%. And I mean, I love that you bring up sort of his natural just way about things, because I mean, just to put a bow on this, and I mean, this is something I want to ask you, but I mean, I've got to share this with you, because my first Gene memory is Frisco Kid, seeing it on VHS. And I mean, I was brought up Jewish. I knew what Lantzman meant. So the second he screams, Lantzman, Lantzman, I was like, it's a kid. I was dying. And it's just the timing and the earnest and just how he sold it is what made it all so beautiful and so funny. And I mean, just to put a bow on this interview, what is your first memory of sort of Gene Wilder?
Oh, okay. Well, I can tell you that it was 50 years ago, exactly. And I was in a movie theater in Long Island where I grew up. And I saw Gene hanging from a jail cell upside down. It was the first time I saw him. And you know, are we black? Is what he said. And of course, the audience went hysterical. And when he stood upright and I saw him, his hair was like out to here. I was 16 and I had hair out to here. It was like crazy. And I thought, wow, you know, I could identify. I never saw an actor like that before that had uncontrollable, unmanageable hair. And I identified with that very much. Little did I know that 50 years ago, I'd be doing a doc about him. But that was my first memory. And of course, you know, the farting scene and everything. I'll tell you a funny story about that. Warner Brothers told Mel, absolutely no, when it came to Blazing Saddles, absolutely no farting. And Mel said, you're right, you got it. No farting. There won't be any farting. I won't do any farting in this film. And then they said, no, you can't punch a horse in a film. And he said, oh, don't worry about it. We will not punch a horse. And you can't use N-words. No N-words in this movie. And he said, okay, fine. And he never, ever listened to that. Thank God. Yeah, otherwise, Blazing Saddles would have been a five-minute movie. So it worked out pretty well. So that was one little story Mel told me.
Well, and you know what? I mean, I think Mel does have a star, but I mean, I love the fact that Gene kind of doesn't, because I mean, he's this beloved icon who was just kind of okay to settle into the background a little bit and just sort of be and sort of play and sort of do what he did and make people laugh. And I mean, honestly, I'm so glad this movie's going to be out there, because just more people need to remember and reminisce about the genius that was Gene Wilder. But I mean, Ron, just thank you again for the work, and thank you so much for the time today. This was a lot of fun.
That's great. Well, I enjoyed talking to you, Dave.
And don't forget to visit our friends over at Bay Street Video for all your DVD, Blu-ray rental, or purchasing needs this summer, as they are still open for curbside and some mailing delivery as well. Over at 1172 Bay Street, Toronto, Ontario, Canada, you can give them a call at 416-964-9088. That's 416-964-9088. Or send them an email at baystreetvideoto@gmail.com for any of your DVD and Blu-ray needs.